say it's a complicated policy, but I think it's actually true. Shannon, you mentioned volunteers. For people listening right now, they want to get involved. What do volunteers do for you? Do you need more?
We were a pretty lean organization, but when we do throw big events, it's really helpful to have volunteers. One thing we just really want to encourage people to do is sign up for our program and then talk about electrification with their friends and family and loved ones and coworkers. That's one of the biggest kind of volunteer activities that someone can do for us probably right now.
Your engagement approach is really based on word of mouth. When people come to that event, it's like they know who the others are.
The other thing people can do is we're always looking for groups to present with. We present in neighborhood associations, faith communities, Earth Day events, all sorts of groups. If you are part of a group that would love to have a visit from us, let us know.
Eli, where will our city be in 20 years?
Well, we'll be awfully close to being a combustion-free city, which will be exciting. Less air pollution, less noise, healthier homes, healthier streets. So that's one thing in this energy world I really look forward to. But it's going to take a couple decades to get there.
What do you think, Shannon?
Oh, I would love to see
you're listening to KBOO Portland.
Thank you for tuning into KBOO Community Radio for this special programming campaign, All Thrills, No Frills, Volume 3. This February and March, you will hear different marathons and series, all brought to you by our talented volunteer programmers, including specials for Black History Month and International Women's Day. If you'd like to help KBOO reach our $22,000 goal by March 16th, go to kboo.fm/give or text the letters KBOO to the number 44321. Do it right now.
Tune in to KBOO's International Women's Day celebration, kicking off on Thursday, March 7th at 8 p.m. with Ears to the Streets of Portland, and wrapping up with a special Women's Day edition of Music from the Truvine on Saturday morning. That's right, this year's celebration will include a full 40 hours of women-centered programming. Again, that's KBOO's International Women's Day special programming, starting at 8 p.m. on Thursday, March 7th, here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland. Catch the full special programming lineup at kboo.fm/IWD.
We're talking today with Deborah Porta of Pride Northwest. Deborah, welcome to Transpositive.
Hi, Emma. How are you?
Good, thank you. And also Katie Cox from the Equi Institute. Katie, welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Thank you. And then finally, we've got Sheila with us, regular co-host. I'm going to have everyone go around and say a little bit about themselves. And if you'd like to give us your pronouns, that would be great. And then we'll kind of get started with today's topic, which is about the state of homelessness in the LGBTQIA plus community. So why don't we start with you, Deborah?
Sure. My name is Deborah Porta, she, they, and I'm the executive director of Pride Northwest. We are located in Portland, but are a statewide organization, best known for the Portland Pride Waterfront Festival and Parade. We're active year-round serving community and advocating for our folks.
Thanks. And how about you, Katie?
Good morning. My name is Katie Cox. I use they and she pronouns, and I'm the executive director and co-founder of the Marie Equi Institute, We're a trans and queer health access organization in the Portland metro area. And we have a community health program that we facilitate, staffed with community health workers and certified recovery mentors. Pardon the crow in the background. we provide peer support and services and systems navigation, harm reduction, health education, and we focus all of that towards unhoused and insecurely housed LGBTQAI2S+ folks.
Thank you. And Sheila, would you like to introduce yourself?
Yes. I think the reason that I'm here today is that I'm a senior trans person, and I am a writer. I've written a book called Transsexualism and Its Discontents that addresses all the different issues historically that the trans community has gone through, and the contrast with the way the narratives are emerging now, and the hyper visibility that we are now subjected to, whereas in the days of yore, we had at least the advantage of our privacy. And so sometimes I feel like I can give a special a witness to those days. And that was the day before pronouns. We were lucky if we were not being assaulted in the streets. So that seems like a luxury. So sometimes I don't even specify pronouns.
Great, thank you. And my name is Emma. I'm a co-host of Transpositive. And today we're going to be talking about the how Portland's houselessness system is failing LGBTQIA+ people. Pride Northwest recently issued a press release. A coalition of nonprofits that serve or advocate for unhoused LGBTQIA 2S+ people, including LGBTQAI 2S+ groups like Basic Rights Oregon and Pride Northwest, released a report. It was a first of a kind report on houselessness among transgender and queer people. And it really goes in. There was a really great report that we're going to be talking about that did a lot of looking at the conditions of what's going on and some possible solutions. And we're going to be really delving into that today. So let's start with Katie and Deborah. Tell us about the report and what you learned from that report.
Thanks, Emma. One of the reasons that I definitely wanted Katie in this conversation is she can speak the best to the report and to really what's happening in the community. The report itself is actually a product of the LGBTQIA2S+ Housing Collaborative, of which Pride Northwest is part. That was formed in response to the emerging crisis coming out of the beginning of the pandemic and the huge influx and increase in housing and food insecurity, mostly housing. And the report is kind of a natural progression of this group of organizations and individuals that began meeting together and coalescing around this issue. Katie is a core part of that and worked directly on the report and can really speak much more eloquently to really the findings, especially in the report.
Great, thanks. Well, let's talk to Katie about it then. The report is LGBTQAI2S+ Houselessness in the Portland Region, a policy paper. Katie, let's get into that then. What's going on with LGBTQAIS+ folks in around housing?
Yeah, thanks, Emma. Yeah, you know, I think one of the pieces that I have been a very squeaky wheel about over the last couple of years is that, you know, Portland is on paper a very LGBTQ-friendly city, right? I think we have the second most dense population of LGBTQ folks in the country at this point, next to San Francisco. And we're also one of, I believe, 20 states in the entire country that covers gender-affirming care through our state Medicaid program. And those are important contextual bits because what we've seen over the last handful of years, particularly particularly since Trump had become president, is just a wave of anti-trans legislation that has been happening across the country. I mean, just this year, 468 bills have been presented for legislation in 41 states, and only 8 have failed so far. The other 460 are still in process, and what that has translated to is a wave of trans and gender diverse folks migrating to safer and more affirming states. And so, you know, Oregon for the last, I guess it's been about 9 years, in 2015, legislation had gone through to cover gender affirming care under state Medicaid. And since that point, we've seen a lot of folks moving to the Portland area just to be able to access that safety or that medical care. And the tricky part about that is that, oftentimes because folks experience so much discrimination and oppression in their lives, particularly LGBTQ folks, and even more particularly transgender and Black and people of color that are also transgender, don't have access to as many resources, right? And so they move here and they don't have a ton of resources to go from. Sometimes they literally just come in a van, and the top priority is to get the medical care that they need. And when they arrive, they're presented with the system in Portland that doesn't have a lot of options for them. The shelters are are mostly binary shelters. So you have your option between being in the men's unit or the women's unit. And that's going to be unsafe for a lot of reasons. And there's not even really an option for our non-binary folks. And so right off the bat, we have a deficit in safe and affirming shelter options. And there are also no housing-specific LGBTQ organizations in the Portland area. Many of us in the LGBTQ Housing Collaborative do have crossover, and that's why we formed this collaborative together. But there's nothing that's specific. And most of the providers that are offering permanent supportive housing or shelter that might be culturally specific programs, such as the Queer Affinity Village, are not managed by culturally specific providers. And they're managed by dominant culture providers. And so there are gaps there as well. And so it's a difficult climate, I think, for our LGBTQ folks, because there's just not a ton of safe and affirming options. And what that ends up looking like is a lot of folks sleeping on the street instead of accessing services.
So how many people are we talking about here? Do we have a rough idea of how many folks in the Portland metro area are LGBTQAI2S+ and unhoused?
That's a great question. We don't have really good data on this topic, and that is one of the pieces that the report brings up. With both the point in time count, which is, an annual count that happens, outreach workers will connect with unhoused folks and take demographic information and, suss things out and create data in that way. There's not a lot of questions on that that assess for gender or sexual gender identity or sexual orientation. And in addition to that, the VISPADAT, which is a vulnerability index survey that folks have to take to be able to get on a list for permanent supportive housing, does not currently include any information on sexual orientation and includes very rudimentary and not fully fleshed out questions about gender identity. That is in the process of being revamped, and I think that we're going to see that might be one of the first places that we're going to see a shift in terms of doing a better job at collecting data on our community within this homeless services system.
But up until this point, it just hasn't been able to give us very good numbers. So we don't have good data around that, and we need to have good data.
I see that in the report. One of the things I saw in the report was that on average, over a period of 6 months, unhoused trans people had an average of 8 jail or prison stays, 21 police contacts, 7.6 emergency room visits, and 2.6 ambulance rides. That sounds like a lot of unmet need is having to be addressed through emergency services because people aren't housed.
Absolutely. That's one of the, you know, to Katie's point, the region that we live in is generally unprepared for some of the circumstances that have developed over the last 5-6 years. You know, in addition to people moving here, we're all pretty familiar, I think, with the huge increase in what it costs to live here, what it costs to be here, rent, all of these things. So there's just a sort of this combination of factors that we're staring at. And one of them is the realization that our infrastructure doesn't support, for lack of a better way to put it, adequate living ability. So there is a huge dependency on emergency response. You know, it's well documented in the news about how often the police are called to respond to things that our mental health structure, mental and emotional health structure in this state is almost non-existent. You know, addiction services, all of these things. And so, yeah, our folks, particularly in the trans community, have a lot of contact with emergency services because they don't have alternatives.
Sheila, would you like to comment on what we've been discussing so far?
Yes, I'd love to. It was very informative, and it's showing the fact basis. I'm kind of a theoretician, and I always try to approach things by trying to put them into context. And I opened today by saying that the transgender world that I came from was largely invisible. We were kind of an appendage to drag culture, and because that was one area where any kind of cross-gender behavior had sort of been shoved off into the bar scene and into the early resistance movements. And even there, we were kind of like guests. There weren't enough of us to really put much of an impact on things. And in fact, sometimes there was even resistance in the gay male community to imply that we were kind of like a remnant. We were part of a culture that they had moved beyond, and so the advantage though that we had was that we didn't have any organized opposition to our existence. Our problem was getting recognition of and especially in the medical community so that we could get some help, because we fell into a gap. It was like being stuck in a valley with steep sides. We couldn't climb out of the hole. And now what's happened is that we are visible, but we're not completely visible. Social acceptance and working us into systems, especially complex medical systems and complex ways of giving people support when they're homeless and other situations, are just beginning to have a box on the checklist for us. And that's a huge step forward, because you remain invisible until you fit into the system. And then the problem is that we're living in an era where our problems are sometimes dwarfed by the massiveness of homelessness in general. There's so many people that are homeless. Families are homeless. We have the immigrant crisis coming on with so many people seeking aid there. And so a lot of times we fall back into the situation where people say, your psychological problem is so small that we've got so many other people to take care of. What you need to do is this, I'm giving you the narrative of many religious communities that will say, your problem is you just got to change your mind. If you'll stop trying to do the impossible, your problems will disappear. And of course, that undercuts the transgender experience, and it reduces it to something that we bring upon ourselves, because it's something that we could get out of. And what I'm noticing as an older trans person is my whole take on transgender existence begins to alter into the generic old person's looking at life. And as our expectations and our time to actuate various life projects get shorter and shorter, all of a sudden, some of the urgency of youth and some of the sexual urgency that accompanied it, I look back and I say, remember what that used to feel like? Does it feel the same way now? And I think it doesn't feel quite the same way now. And plus, you kind of move into a spiritual zone where you feel sorry for everybody. I used to think of myself as primarily as so focused on the trans issues that I didn't have sufficient compassion for the whole human race. And lately, what I'm looking at, all the ways that people suffer and all the different groups that are discriminated against, and I feel that the real value of our experience is that we focus so many issues of anxiety and hatred in the overall community, and sometimes we even get imported to stuff that's not ours. A link today to some people that said, look at the equation of being trans to being a pedophile, and look at how we're getting hit with stuff that's not even ours. And so what I'd like to focus on is sometimes we have aid that will help us. And so we have people working for us that were never our allies before. But I can imagine the distance of being an exile, an immigrant within your own country, essentially, an illegal person in the state where you were, where you lived your whole life. And then you show up thinking you've come to the promised land. And is there a promised land to come to? And I'm always so scared to discourage people. But it's so important that we face our issues. So I'm so glad of what we're doing today.
Thank you, Sheila. So in the report that was done on the condition of homelessness, there were several conditions that were looked at by this group. What is the group again? The Housing Justice Coalition?
The LGBTQAI2S+ Housing Collaborative.
Oh, great. Thank you so much. I see that it recommends... it says the issues that are affecting folks are eviction, an adequate lack of transitional housing, having management for housing, having permanent housing, supportive services. Can you address some of these issues, Katie, that are really specific? I mean, let's get into a little bit of detail on what are the issues specifically that are making trans, everybody from the whole spectrum homeless, and how can we address those needs?
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the areas that we see a lot, and which is actually one of the areas that Portland is doing, I think, better at than in other areas, is homeless services for youth, because we see a lot of youth that will come out to their families and not be accepted and no longer feel safe or affirmed in their home. And the only other option is to be homeless. So that's a common situation that happens that starts folks off on that foot of being incredibly under-resourced. And I think that the other pieces are really tied in to discrimination pervasive discrimination that happens in just a lot of different areas, you know, accessing employment, accessing actual housing. I've heard reports from many folks that have had a lot of barriers put up to accessing those two very basic needs because of that pervasive discrimination. And I think our community in general, because of that discrimination and the rhetoric that we hear that tells us that we shouldn't exist, blocks us from accessing those very basic resources in general, which is, it's just going to kick us off on that under-resourced, you know, from that under-resourced space. And so we have access to less money, less housing, and sometimes even less education, which can also translate to employment. So all of those pieces kind of stacked up contribute to the issue. And in terms of, you know, what we do have in Portland, as I mentioned, we do have youth services. So we've got new avenues for youth, the Sexual and Gender Minority Youth Resource Center, and the Living Room. Those are all spaces where trans and queer youth can get some of their basic needs met and also get connected to housing. But in terms of, like, once you age out of that youth system, that's where resources become a little bit more sparse. There are, I think right now in this moment, there are more resources than there ever have been for our community. And part of that, I think, is, you know, in part due to the work that the LGBTQAI2S Plus Housing Collaborative has been doing, but also in part of just these individual organizations who decided to take pieces of this work on, such as Black and Beyond the Binary Collective, since 2020 has provided emergency rental assistance, prioritizing gender and non-binary Black folks and Indigenous folks. And has worked really closely with the PDX Trans Housing Coalition to provide respite, hotel respite, and kind of, you know, meeting those gap needs. And then, of course, Cascade AIDS Project has been a longstanding Portland organization, and they do provide some permanent supportive housing and some emergency rent assistance. However, it is specific for folks living with HIV or AIDS. So that's an important piece there. They're one of the largest, LGBTQ orgs in the Portland metro area. However, they, you know, they're niched out, and it's very, their services are very specific.
I see that in the report, one of the things I saw, I'm sorry to interrupt. One of the reports I saw was that the ACWI Institute offers housing case management. Is that also one of the services that?
Yes. So back in 2020, we were part of the coalition, the Creating Conscious Communities with People Outside Coalition, that got the first three Safe Rest Villages off the ground. And we worked within that coalition to carve out a space for the Queer Affinity Village, which is to this day the only LGBTQ specific shelter in the entire state. A lot of folks that we worked with there while we're no longer working in the village, because the contract changed hands, we've stayed connected with those folks. And so we've seen them get into housing, and we've been able to, you know, our peer workers go in and support them, make sure, you know, they learn some new skills that maybe they didn't have before around, you know, staying organized and keeping up with apartment inspections, accessing food, learning how to cook, general peer support, substance use recovery support. So kind of like all of the, I would say, social determinants of health to help ensure like a smooth transition, because it's a big transition going from, you know, living outside to living inside. And so we, you know, our peer workers provide a lot of that, that case management through a queer and trans lens.
I also see on the report that one of the recommendations is to increase the number of temporary shelters that are non-binary. Could either you or Deborah address that policy recommendation?
Yeah, Deborah, do you want to touch on it? I feel like I've been talking a lot, but I'm also happy to step into it if you need.
I mean, that's pretty straightforward. It, you know, Katie mentioned early on that, you know, the current shelter structure isn't designed for our folks, and it makes a big difference to the experience there. The current system, there's lots of empirical data about how unsafe it is and all of that, and how traumatizing it is to not be able to identify as who you are. And you know, having non-binary space is important to the success of being able to navigate those systems.
Thanks. Would you like to add anything to that, Katie?
Yeah. I think that having space for non-binary and, you know, gender expansive folks in general is really important, because it just doesn't feel safe for most folks to be in those binary spaces. Even if they are even if they're transgender and binary themselves, because you're still going to end up in a room, you know, if you're a trans man, you're still going to end up in a room with a bunch of cisgender men who may or may not understand your gender identity or expression, and it can be dangerous. And so having those carved out spaces for our community is deeply important, and it's a very important part of this ecosystem that we want to see.
There's also another recommendation here that really touches back to something Sheila was mentioning. It's to factor sexual orientation and gender identity into the vulnerability index prioritization decision assistance tool, which is a tool that's used to triage for people experiencing houselessness. Sheila, could you return to your comment about how if you're not able to be put on a checkbox, you're not even like part of the system? I just thought that was a really great point you made earlier.
Well, thanks so much. I think this might help to kind of tell a personal experience how I dealt with the era when there was no checkbox. In my very early years, I was part of a service down at the Matt Talbot Center in Portland, and it was a place where you had to be clean and sober at least for a day. You couldn't come in drunk. And it was an old building off of Cooch Street right down from Darcell's. And we'd admit people all the time, and we basically ran the place after dark, and I had never been trained for that. And as part of that, I went around the neighborhood, and also got, this was before all the gentrification had taken place, and I noticed that there were places where you could put in $1 a day and you'd have it in a cubicle. It was like, and there was chicken wire across the top of these things, so that if guys, and there was no problem to bring your bottle up there, and two guys had combined their funds and have a place to stay for the night, and the chicken wire was, so if you threw your bottle, it wouldn't land on the head of the person next to you. And I thought, boy, this is about as gut level as anything. I would have been a little suburban kid. I'd never seen anything like this. But we don't have stuff like that anymore, where there's kind of an interface between where you've fallen completely off the grid, and yet there's something where you're not going to be in that Portland rain freezing overnight. And that's the world that I remember. And my own situation was that I accepted exile and moved out on two boats and lived for 20 years, paying very little rent. They've closed that window now. It's very hard to find that. You can't live aboard like it used to be possible. So what I think happens when we're trying to open these boxes is that part of social narrative is getting so that people in positions of power can start talking about you and saying, how can we from inside make room for these people? And then we've got the overlapping problem that many of us in our looking for a body image for ourselves experiment with you know, various things that feel innerly liberating, unusual hair colors, unusual hairstyles, and so we're always aware that we're trying to merge with a society that makes room for divergence when you're a rock star. But if an everyday person tries to look like a rock star, they're not necessarily, they're going to draw a lot of attention. And because of the way that the economy works, a lot of people are uncomfortable with that image. So it isn't our identity, it's how we manifest our identity. Like I used to have people say, well, you always wear too much makeup. Well, that's because I want to be pretty. And these are the kind of people that I like to look like. I want to be glamorous. I want to be noticed. I don't want to be invisible. I'll wait, save that for where I'm old. Now I'm old and I'm still doing it. So there it is with
still,
all this.
You still look fabulous, Sheila. You still look fabulous. You really do.
Thank you.
So I'd like to ask another there was another policy recommendation in the report, and that was to hold non-LGBTQAI2S+ houseless service providers responsible for providing culturally responsive services, which I think is a great recommendation. Could you comment on that, Katie?
Absolutely. This is a piece that that I try to talk to everybody I can about, because particularly, you know, being a trans and queer specific organization serving trans and queer people, we hear all the time from folks about the horror stories of neglect and just like the complete opposite of care for our folks from dominant culture service providers. And sometimes it's really intentional, sometimes it's not intentional, but the impact is still there. And it really is. And that's impact that we need to address collectively. And it's something that I have been speaking really closely with the equity manager at the Joint Office of Homeless Services about. Her name is Emily Nelson. She is absolutely wonderful. And I'm so, so glad that she's in the position that she is. She brings some lived experience to the role that I think is really important. And we have talked at length about this particular topic and developing tools for providers, dominant culture providers, so that they can assess, you know, where they are in providing affirming and equitable services, and then make a plan, you know, an actual equity plan for them to move towards providing more equitable and affirming services. It's also a piece, I've been sitting on the Joint Office of Homeless Services Provider Conference Planning Committee, and we've been talking a lot about that there, and just developed a rubric for folks to put, you know, providers to put proposals through for the conference and assess, you know, how are you bringing equity into your organization? What does that look like? How are you going to tell us, you know, about the work that you're doing, and also explain how you're doing it equitably? So I think this is that accountability is really important, because the culturally specific organizations, we can't hold it all. We can't hold it all. We need our allies in this work. And even though it can be strenuous to put forth that labor to bring them along, I definitely see it as a necessary part of the work. Deborah?
Yeah, I just want to what Katie has said brings up a really big point that I think is worthy of being called out, and that's recognizing how important it's been for particularly Katie, but Equi and some others to be in certain spaces that we may not have been in before. You know, as has been mentioned, Portland, Oregon, but mostly Portland, has this reputation for being, very queer friendly and all of these things. And we have the services, we have the legal right to lots of things here, right? But that doesn't mean that all of those things manifest all the time. And with the onset of the pandemic, it became really clear really fast how easily our community could be left out and ignored in places where we weren't before, because we weren't visible anymore, we weren't seen. It was very easy to shut us out. And particularly in Equi's work and CAP as well, Quest is in spaces where the decisions are changing, the resources are starting to flow differently. And I think that has a lot to do with having these folks in those spaces, being part of that decision making and impacting those decisions and those decision makers. So I don't want to gloss over that, because I think that is really key to the slow shifting that is beginning to happen at this point. And yes, progress is happening, but it is definitely slow. But I just want to sort of call that out so that because I think it's important that our community recognize that we don't and haven't held the sway that we think we do. And so for folks like Katie, Jonathan at CAP, et cetera, to be in spaces where we weren't before, there's a game changer happening in there.
That's great. I mean, I see that the paper itself was created by Basic Rights Oregon, Black and Beyond the Binary, Cascades AIDS Project, Equi Institute, PDX Trans Housing Coalition, Pride Northwest, Quest Center for Integrative Health, Q Center, and Lucas M. Soto Consulting. That's an impressive list of local advocacy groups focused specifically on this issue. That sounds like a winning team.
Yeah, it was definitely. I think I'm about to speak over Katie. The long term impact of these organizations coming together on this issue, and it was very organic, the process for getting here in terms of us meeting together and getting to know each other, because in my experience in this community, and I've been around for a minute, this was really the first time that I had seen this happen to such a substantial place for organizations to consistently be connecting, working through things, et cetera. So that gives me a lot of hope as well for our ability to come together and really make change as a community.
Thanks, Katie. Did you want to say something?
Yeah, just to dovetail off of that. Yeah, absolutely. I've been doing this work for almost 10 years, and similarly have not seen this type of organic and collaborative effort with nearly all of the LGBTQ specific organizations in the metro area. And I knew, you know, I've been talking about this in as many spaces as I can for a long time, and couldn't make any movement, you know, because I'm just one person. And I think in our current systems, that makes me easier to ignore. And so, when Deborah and I had been talking about it, that was when we were like, we need more folks at the table. That was really the birth of the housing collaborative was, you know, we need to get everybody in on this because our voices are going to be stronger together. And that felt like a really, really important piece. And it did, it shifted like almost, you know, within a year. It took a year. We did a bunch of ecosystem mapping. We hosted a lot of electeds in our space. We hosted former Commissioner Sushila Jayapal, who has been a big champion for our work. Lex Yakusovsky, who is the LGBTQ policy analyst at the City of Portland. We spoke with folks at the, you know, Equity and Inclusion, City of Portland Equity and Inclusion Office, and just started to kind of map things out. And through all of those conversations and connecting with the folks in power, essentially, that held some power, we started to move the needle. And I'm a big proponent of collaboration in general. I believe inevitably we are stronger, we are better when we do it together.
Thanks. Sheila, I'd like to come back to a comment you made earlier that I think is kind of a good way to head toward the end of our interview here. You were addressing the issue of marginalized housing, which is also a really big issue in the LGBTQAI2S+ community. I know a lot of folks who sometimes they're homeless, sometimes they're living in a van, sometimes they're living on a boat, sometimes they're homeless again. Could you address that issue, Sheila? Just, as somebody who I think has lived experience with it, what role does marginalized housing play in this whole discussion?
I think that that was the way that the society that I grew up in dealt with divergence. It is funny. There's always an interface between economics and sociology. And so the answer in those days where you'd have certain parts of town that were run down, this is the whole question of gentrification. The value of real estate has to be below a certain amount before you can afford to give cheap services to people that do not have large incomes. And as cities develop and they gentrify those areas, they eliminate what used to be called the slums. Well, the slums was actually, in some ways, it was nasty, but it was a refuge, and it was available, and it was workable, and it was organic. You didn't have to go through any kind of screening. You just asked somebody, the old days of Jack Kerouac, bumming around America and saying, where do I go? And he'd always know there'd be a part of town where he could sit there, and it would be icky, but he could live. And what I'm thinking is we're in the interface stage right now where networking, synergy, and connection are happening. And this is ironic that we're speaking in this particular year because we are sailing into a hurricane. I always think of that great movie, Perfect Storm, where they're sailing into the really bad weather. Well, I'm afraid to get my passport renewed right now because I want to go with the non-declaration of gender. And then I kept thinking about the Holocaust with the Yellow Star, and I said, you're going to make it awful easy to sit there and have a certain group of people who want to scoop you all up. And as ironic, as weird as that seems, it could happen. And the other thing is I wanted to hit an analogy here that suddenly occurred to me. They used to have things before video games called pinball machines. And you pulled a little thing and it shot a ball bearing up and it bounced around and then it finally fell at the end. And you get points for how long you could keep it floating. Well, I think that's the position of trans people, is that the game is tilted so that our little destiny is to fall into the gutter and disappear. And we're seen as a threat to the nuclear family. And therefore, if life can be made sufficiently hard for us, we will reintegrate into straight society is the best that can be offered by very conservative voices. But the real trick is to make sure that you don't fall down into that box too early. And so much of our trans youth, either through drugs or despair or sexual exploitation, falls down, and you don't stay up there in the little slots long enough to score. And a lot of survival in this world is just being out there long enough that you can go through your maturation stages. And when you have counselors, and especially peer counseling, to help you, you can avoid some of the pitfalls that end up where we end up on the Day of Remembrance. That's the saddest of all. But so I, using that little analogy, I think what our goal should be as a community is to survive long enough that we don't get hurt. And the more we can talk to each other, the more we can interface with people of goodwill in other areas that are not, don't share our orientation, the better chance we have to staying floating up there and not being down at the bottom, where we tend to gravitate. And with me, as I said, I lived in a very unique situation. I had to survive on the day-to-day thing, and I just took whatever was offered because that was all that was there. In retrospect, now from my perspective of being a more aged person, I wish I'd been less discouraged. I wish I'd been in there and said, don't give up so easy. Don't just accept whatever has been allotted to you just for survival. You can do better than survival. But at the time, survival itself was good enough for me. So I think it's so important that we constantly give people hope that they can be better and better and better, and don't just fall into a slot and stay there, because that's essentially what happened to me.
Thank you. So we're getting kind of near the end of our interview. I just wanted to give you, Katie, a chance to tell our listeners a little bit about the Equi Institute. I know that most of our queer audience probably knows about the Equi Institute, but for folks who don't, what do you do there and what kind of services do you offer?
Yeah, we facilitate a community health program, and our services are really tailored towards filling in as many gaps in our existing systems as possible. And we do that through peer work. So all of our peer workers, almost all, I think we have one non-trans or queer person, but the rest of our peer workers are trans and or queer identified. And many of them bring lived experience of houselessness, of substance use, of transness. And they assist folks in navigating to gender affirming care, navigating through homeless service systems, navigating just through general healthcare systems, providing health education, encouragement, really walking alongside folks, because it's hard. It can be hard to do it alone, you know, especially in these systems that are dominant culture systems. And not set up for our community. And so our peer workers really do that, you know, I'm going to hold your hand through this and root for you along the way. And that's a piece that, as far as I know, is not well represented in the metro area, certainly, and definitely across the state. That trans and queer peer specific type of work. So while we no longer do primary care, we help folks get to the primary care and, you know, support, remove the barriers with them along the way and help them map out their health goals. We also have certified recovery mentors. We're a Measure 110 funding recipient. And so we have an arm of our programming that is specific for folks with substance use disorder. And we do that from a harm reduction lens. And when folks are ready for recovery, like, we're there to help support them through it. All of our services are particularly tailored for unhoused or insecurely housed, you know, low-income individuals. And later this year, We will be opening a first of its kind in the region, trans and queer supportive services center. This is going to be a day center. We're receiving day center funding from the Joint Office of Homeless Services to develop this project. And we will be able to provide, you know, our community health program out of that space. But we will also be working with other community partners to really centralize as many supportive and social services as we can in one space that is safe and affirming and reflective of our community. So I'm really, really excited for that piece. And hopefully we'll be launching that in the summer, June or July of this year.
Thanks. And if people want to get in touch with the Equi Institute, if they need to connect for services, how can they reach you?
Yeah, our website is a good first stop, www.equi-institute.org. You can also shoot us an email at info@equi-institute.org. We're also on Facebook and Instagram. And currently, until we move into our own, a home of our own, we have an office inside of the Q Center on Mississippi, where we provide drop-in hours on Mondays and Tuesdays from noon to four. So we have peer workers ready and available to support folks in whatever ways they need, Mondays and Tuesdays, noon to four, which also coincides with the Hand Up People's Food Pantry at Q Center as well. So if you have food access needs, you can kind of kill two birds with one stone there.
Great, thanks. And Deborah, thanks so much for joining us with Pride Northwest. If you want to find out more about Pride Northwest and the services that Pride Northwest provides, how can they reach you?
Sure. Thank you for having me, as always. So Pride, our website is also the best place to start for us. PrideNW.org has our programs, has our resource pages, how to reach out, how to get on the newsletter. That's the best way to stay up to date. You know, we also have new programming rolling out as well. So it's a big year, but definitely start with the website.
Great, thanks. And Sheila, thanks so much for joining us again. We've definitely promoted your book before, but if you'd like to tell people again, how can they find your book, Transsexualism and Its Discontents?
It's up on Amazon. It's also up on Barnes & Noble and called Transsexualism and Its Discontents.
Great, thank you. Thanks to all of you so much for joining us today for Trans Positive. Have a good day.
Transgender people don't live here.
I've never met anyone who's transgender.
I swear I don't know someone who's transgender.
Transgender and non-binary people like me hear this all the time.
But according to the HRC Foundation, there are more than 2 million transgender people in the United States.
We live in every community across this country.
You might be surprised to hear that there are more transgender and non-binary people in the United States than there are
Starbucks, McDonald's, and Walmart locations combined.
In fact, if you put us all together,
there'd be more non-binary and transgender folks than the populations of DC,
or Nebraska,
or Maine,
or Idaho,
or West Virginia.
As a matter of fact, 15 states have a lower population than the amount of trans folks in the U.S.
So here are a few things to keep in mind.
You don't always know when a person is trans.
But we're your neighbors,
your coworkers,
your students,
your customers,
and even your friends and family.
We exist in every culture, todas las culturas, throughout human history.
And while we're more visible than ever before,
sometimes you just don't see us.
So when you hear about politicians pushing for discriminatory bills,
know this, these bills address problems that aren't even real.
Problems that don't actually exist.
But we do.
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 And we need your support.
Always free. Every-
Hi, this is Emma. I am a co-host of Transpositive, and I'm also the current president of the board of directors here at KABU. At KABU, we prove every day that people-powered radio has the ability to bring us together across distances and give us hope when we feel despair. Your friends at KABU want to remind you that generosity has the same power. Join thousands of KABU supporters from all around the world, and let's rally together to build stronger communities. If you can, just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to this number 44321. And thanks so much for your support of KBOO Community Radio. Bedroom surprise.
We're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2H2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
You're listening to KBOO, All Thrills, No Frills, Volume 3 Special Programming Campaign. Check out all the great special programs we're bringing you in February and March at kboo.fm/thrills. Help us reach our goal of $22,000 by March 16th. You can go to kboo.fm/give or text us. Type in KBOO to the number 44321. The number again is 44321. For the thrill of it all, keep listening.